All right, Sven Groot, man. You've been a long-time Niner. Since when?
Yes, I have. I've been on the site since 2005.
Uh-huh.
I think I actually visited it once when it opened, but then I didn't really get what the idea behind it was. I think I saw it on Rory's blog back then.
Excellent.
But I didn't really get the idea.
You didn't get the idea?
And about a year later, I came back and saw the forums and stuff and signed up. And
since then, I've
been active.
Cool. So I see you have your Microsoft tag on.
Oh, yeah.
You're visiting us?
Tech.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just visiting Seattle. Not Microsoft in particular, but happens to be in Seattle.
Absolutely. So why did you pick Seattle, of all the places to take a vacation?
Well, basically because I wanted to meet with Christian.
Excellent.
Which is Little Guru.
Little Guru.
Yeah.
All right.
Because he told me he was moving here because he was going to work for Microsoft.
Yes, we hired him.
So when he said he was going to move to Microsoft, I said, okay, I'll come visit you. Because I'm on the other side of the Pacific, so it's sort of a easy way to fly.
Excellent. So one of the things I've noticed, because I, of course, monitor the forums, whether people realize it or not, I'm always on pretty much all the forums. And I've noticed that you tend to be one of the more technical Niners in the sense that you're in tech off, you help people, whether it's C++, whether it's C#. So thank you. I really appreciate it. We all really appreciate that. I definitely appreciate that. What I would ask you is, what are you studying, and what is it about software that excites you? I mean, why are you getting a PhD in software, some form of engineering? Tell us a little bit about that.
That's a good question. It goes back a long way, actually.
Good.
Yeah. I think my first real time that I got interested in dealing with software was when my dad brought an MSX 2 from school.
Excellent.
I think the MSX isn't really known in the US, though.
Okay.
But it's a Japanese computer, but it was also released in Europe.
Okay.
But I think it's not really well known in the US.
I don't recall it.
Yeah. It's sort of like a Commodore 64. That's sort of the type of thing that you need to think of.
Sure.
I think it's Z80 based.
Okay.
But so we had games on that, and some of those games were written in BASIC.
Mm.
So sometimes you would get a syntax error in line 800. And then I tried to figure out what was actually happening there.
Excellent.
Not that I actually managed to fix any of those, because I didn't really know BASIC at all.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you had to type commands to get things running.
Mm.
Well, at some point we got a PC, and my uncle was actually a professional developer.
Ah.
And he lent me a book about Microsoft BASIC.
Excellent.
And that's how I got started, at age 10.
All right, age 10.
Yes.
Nice, man.
And basically, as long as I can remember, I've known that I wanted to study computer science. I don't really know what brought that on, other than, you know, just the... I find the whole thing fascinating.
Sure.
How these things work, making them do what you want to do.
Yeah. Excellent. So, what are you studying? I mean, you're in a PhD program. You're going to be Dr. Sven Groot at some point. What is your expertise?
I'm currently in database engineering.
Okay.
And specifically, I'm working on data-intensive computing.
Excellent.
It still sounds very vague.
Not really. I mean, we get it. I mean, you're the one that asked me to do an interview on Dryad.
Exactly.
I mean, okay.
Yeah, it's sort of that kind of area, like Google MapReduce, Microsoft Dryads, mm-hmm. and Hadoop is the open source version sponsored by Yahoo.
Okay.
That's sort of that kind of thing, is processing massive quantities of data on large clusters in a fault-tolerant and also hopefully efficient way.
Sure.
Right now we've kind of see that we get one or the other. It's either fault-tolerant or it's efficient.
Hmm.
It's especially MapReduce. Well, I can't really speak for Google's MapReduce because that's really secret.
Sure.
But as far as Yahoo goes, the Hadoop thing, it really... Well, if any of them are watching, they probably won't appreciate me saying this, but they really sacrifice a lot of efficiency to get that
fault tolerance
going.
Why not? Let me, you're the expert here. You know, what is it about fault tolerance versus efficiency? I mean, it's probably because there's a lot of extra processing that has to go on to be fault tolerant, or isolation that limits the ability to be fast or whatnot. Tell us.
Well, one of the main things is that you need to materialize all your intermediate results. Mm. Everything needs to be written to disk at some point, because otherwise if one small process fails and you lose the intermediate state, you have to restart the whole thing. Oh. And that's sort of what they try to prevent. And even if you were to lose an entire server, you would still just need to re-execute those little bits of the job that server was responsible for. Mm. But as a result, you need to write everything to disk, so disk speed becomes a bottleneck. Especially because the whole MapReduce framework is basically a giant sorting engine. Hmm. So everything ends up being sorted, and doing external sorts on disk is not all that quick. And the thing with MapReduce is basically it was designed by Google to solve their particular data processing needs. And now it's being adopted by a lot of other people to do a lot of other things which it really hasn't been designed to do.
Sure.
And in some cases you can see kinds of jobs where MapReduce really does a lot of stuff, like the sorting in the middle and say, and materializing all the intermediate results, and it may not actually be necessary. And you end up with something that is much less efficient than a regular parallel database. Mm. It might actually be good at particular types of jobs, but a lot of people are sort of treating it like the holy grail of data processing, which it really isn't, in my opinion.
Okay.
And which is why it's nice that things like Microsoft Dryad are nice, because they are more flexible. They don't require you to follow that MapReduce model.
Sure.
So they can do more more stuff.
Yeah, well, it's more general purpose.
Yeah, exactly. Which, on the other hand, again, makes it harder to parallelize efficiently. Because the nice thing about MapReduce, it's really easy to parallelize.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. Why?
Well, with MapReduce, you basically divide your job into two layers. And the first layer will do basically a one-to-one mapping. You take one input record, and it produces one or more output records. It doesn't necessarily need to produce one. Mm. But it doesn't do anything with the rest of the data. It just looks at one record at a time, which means that you can just split your input data into very big pieces.
Okay.
And just say, this server is going to process the first 64 megabytes, and this server is going to process the next 64 megabytes, and this server the next, etc. Mm-hmm. So that makes it very easy to parallelize the map phase. And then for the reduce phase, basically you run multiple reduce tasks also on every node in the cluster. Mm. The output of the map tasks is partitioned to be split among all these reduce tasks, which unfortunately means that you end up sending data between every node in the cluster. Mm. So that also means that if your network is not properly provisioned, you can very easily get a network bottleneck on that.
Sure. Interesting.
But it's still, basically you're just splitting your data in a very natural way. But the thing is, your data has to be suitable for things to be split in that way, mm-hmm. to be processed in that way. If you're doing something where you do need to cross-reference a lot of records and stuff, then you end up building very strange workarounds. I've seen these kinds of things, that the people try to map existing data processing jobs on the MapReduce. And you end up building these really weird things where the map phase actually doesn't really do any mapping as such, but just tries to get all the related data under one key, so the reduce job will see it all together.
Okay.
And then the reduced task does the actual processing. It's just and these kind of things, they don't really fit in there, but people are trying to fit them in anyway. Mm. And then they will write papers and saying, yeah, we get great scalability. And that's true, they get great scalability because MapReduce scales really well as long as you have sufficient network bandwidth and sufficient disks and stuff. Mm. But if you actually look at the base level performance, that's not very high. Mm. So I found that in certain scenarios, you can actually have you will need something on the order of between 2 to 6 times the number of servers to get similar performance to a parallel database.
Interesting.
And it continues to scale well, and maybe at some point you will overtake the parallel database system because it doesn't scale as well. But if you have a smaller cluster, then MapReduce has such a level of overhead for some kinds of jobs that it just isn't worth it. And it's especially bad when you need to do a very complex job, because at least in the Hadoop implementation, I can't say what Google does nowadays because their MapReduce paper is from 2004, I think. So who knows what they're doing by now?
Sure.
Well,
I know that those guys watch Channel 9 because I've met some Google engineers, and they actually really like listening to what Microsoft's doing. So maybe we need to be a little less transparent on Channel 9. But anyway,
yeah, I should maybe not be too transparent about what I'm doing, because you guys are one of my biggest competitors in this field. And
absolutely. Well, no, you don't. I mean, PhDs are all about IP, man. So we don't have to go down that path. I get that.
So I don't want to be too specific, because otherwise I get scooped.
Sure. So you're interested in database engineering, but what I'd ask you is, of all the sort of possibilities in computing, why did you choose that? I mean, it's a very interesting problem. But there's also an interesting problem with parallelism on the client. What if you have 1,000 cores?
Yeah.
Right? Someone, you know, Microsoft hasn't figured that. No one's figured that out yet. So my question is simply, what is it about data and databases that really appeal to you? Because when you first started with computing, it was on the client, and you learned about simple programming language that orders the...
And actually, my master's was in something completely different.
Cool.
The main thing, actually, to be completely honest here, it's because of the way I got to Japan. Because my... advisor, the professor I graduated under in Netherlands for my master's, he knew the professor at Tokyo University.
Cool.
And his lab happens to specialize in databases.
Fair enough.
So that's sort of one of the reasons why I got in there. But of course, I do actually find it interesting. Otherwise, I would have said no.
Of course. Yeah.
But I'm one of these people who finds a lot of things interesting, and it's actually always very hard for me to pick one thing that I want to concentrate on, because then I'll get distracted. Because indeed, then I'll see a paper or something about client parallelism or something, and I think, oh, that's interesting too, and then I'll spend a week working on that, even though it has nothing to do with my own work.
Sure. But I mean, in some sense, when you get a PhD, at least for a high percentage of people in this industry, you're not going to be locked in. Right. Let's assume like you get your PhD, and then of course we're going to try to recruit you if we're smart. And
perhaps,
you know, it doesn't mean you're going to end up working on the SQL team. I mean, the kind of skills you're going to have with general purpose, essentially supercomputing anyway, or parallelism. Right. Parallelism versus concurrency. People kind of get them confused. They're not the same thing. As you well know, you're going to take a bunch of data, and then take many many concurrent tasks to analyze the data and then put it all back together and send it back down to the client, right? That's the ultimate problem.
Yeah.
So that problem actually applies to much more than just, you know, the database model or the Hadoop model or the Dryad, blah, 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 which is really cool. General purpose supercomputing, man.
Yeah. Actually, in my old university, Leiden University in the Netherlands, we called that the T model. It's people who follow the T model of education. So they get a very broad understanding of a lot of subjects, and then one subject that they're very deep in, and that looks like a T.
Absolutely. That's a good thing, especially in this industry.
Yeah.
Although in this industry, it might actually be like, you might want to think about an I. Right? So you have broad initially, then you go deep, and then you broaden based on that deep. Maybe you have another kind of like a vector to some other thing that you're, you know, to be broad in. So... really cool. The more people studying parallelism and concurrency and supercomputing or general purpose, whatever you want to call it.
Because this is one of the big issues at the moment.
Dude, it's huge.
I mean, and we're seeing basically, at least in this kind of data processing field, is that it's getting more and more common to use very large clusters of relatively small PCs instead of using one shared everything huge supercomputer. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have those as well. But
sure.
But for data processing, they tend to like to use a lot of computers, mm-hmm. especially because data processing tends to be limited on disks, so it doesn't really matter that much if you have 1,000 CPUs or anything.
Sure.
Just if you have enough disks, that's the main thing.
Sure, and enough, you know, L2 cache.
Yeah.
Because you got to, because that's the other another big problem that we have facing the industry, right? I mean, I keep saying 1,000 cores. It's not super realistic, but
yeah.
100 cores is, and when you get 100 cores on a single chip, there's going to be cache optimization problems, and that's another thing that Microsoft and hardware people have not figured out yet, and that's something we're both working on. So
yeah, that's a little bit lower level than what I'm working at.
So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, so you're programming, I'm assuming, mostly in C++, C?
I'm actually working in C#.
Really?
Yes.
Nice.
I'm using Mono to run it on Linux clusters.
Okay. And how's that going? Without getting into details of what you're doing, what's that experience like?
It's pretty interesting. Mono has been very helpful. It definitely means that I can just use Visual Studio on my own PC and then run it on Linux
clusters. So that actually works pretty well.
Yeah, that actually works pretty well.
Nice.
They're pretty compatible with Mono, with the real .NET framework. Mm. There's been a few places where I needed to code around something. There's something like drive information. That class doesn't really return anything on Unix.
Okay.
Because they have this problem that they don't want to depend on a certain other library which they need to get that information on Unix. So their implementation is just empty.
Interesting.
And they have another class that does give you that information. It's called Unix drive information or something like that. So basically, I have to write some special case code in some cases to switch to that class to get the free disk space and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there's a few things like that and a few small bugs where Mono just deviates a little bit from the way the .NET framework does it. That's also because Mono tries to work based off the specs and the documentation and not looking at how .NET actually works. For one thing, I think they actually have a strict rule that their programmers are not allowed to have seen either the, you know, Rotor or the shared source CLI.
Okay.
Because or the reference source, what's that called, the new one?
I don't know what the one's called, I'm sorry.
Anyway, because that's, if people have seen that and then they write Mono code, they might reuse some of the code they've seen. And
that's a no-no.
Yeah, because that's, you know, maybe a potential patent infringement or something, or copyright infringement.
Understood.
So sometimes they deviate a little, but on the whole, it is remarkably compatible. They've really done an amazing job on that.
Now, what about their garbage collector, though?
Yeah,
they don't have Patrick Dessoud.
Yeah, that's my only big complaint about Mono, is their garbage collector. They are working on a replacement, but that's going to take a while. Mm-hmm. And their current garbage collector is just an off-the-shelf Berms GC,
okay,
which is not generational.
Ooh.
And yeah, it has some other weird things. It doesn't really like to release memory, actually. It will clean up the managed heap, but
doesn't release it.
Yeah, it doesn't release it back to the OS, which makes it very hard to figure out how much memory your processor is actually using, because it just keeps climbing.
Interesting.
And that's been a bit complicated when I do need to deal with some large pieces of data at some point. I found it much more than I would have done with real .NET. I tried to optimize for reusing objects and things like that just to reduce the load of the GC. Because another big problem with this GC, it uses a stop-the-world approach.
Which is not good on the server, man.
No. Which, that means that you... whenever the GC runs, nothing else runs. All threads are stopped. So, which is annoying if you have multiple threads.
Of course.
The model I'm working with does tend to use multiple processes instead of multiple threads, just to keep that fault tolerance up, so they don't really interfere that much with each other.
Interesting.
I have been doing a lot of like micro benchmarks to see where those trade-offs lie between trying to just run it in parallel with multiple processes, or trying to read from one data source and then split it over multiple threads and things like that. And that's also an interesting problem. And I think that Dryad does that fairly well, actually. Hadoop doesn't do anything with that. They just run it in multiple processes.
Interesting. So let me ask you, what is it like going from the Netherlands to Japan? And then the other question on top of that is, what is your life like in Tokyo? I mean, what is a PhD student in Tokyo? What is that like for you?
Going from the Netherlands to Japan, well, I'm not one of these people who gets culture shock very easily.
Okay, cool.
I basically adapt to any place I am and very easily. It is a very different mindset. The Dutch are known for being very direct.
Yes.
It's always saying what they think.
Yeah.
I'm one of those people as well.
I noticed that. That's good. Hey, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah. And the Japanese, on the other hand, they don't do that.
Okay.
They always sugarcoat everything. They don't tell you what they think. They never say no.
Mm.
And that's very difficult, especially if you want to ask someone a favor. Because if you want to ask someone, hey, could you do this and this for me? They won't say no, even if they don't want to do it. They think it's impolite to say no, so they don't say no.
Oh.
So you always feel a bit bad when you're asking a favor, because you don't know if he actually has time to do it or if he's just saying yes because he doesn't want to say no to you. Yeah, other than that, well, it's nice the trains run on time.
I bet.
And it's a lot of people. That's just something to get used to. From the Netherlands to Japan, it's a big change. If you were to go from here to Japan, that would be ridiculous. Because it's so empty here. There's no one here.
Well, have you been downtown yet?
Yeah.
Since Chris has taken you around?
Yeah, it's downtown Seattle. It looks like Tokyo in the middle of the night.
Absolutely. But we like our space here in the Northwest now.
Yeah. I mean, Japan doesn't really have any space. That's
sure.
The problem.
It's a huge city with lots of people.
Yeah. The population of Japan is 120 million.
Wow.
Which is like a third or something of the U.S.
Okay.
And the amount of space that they have compared to the U.S. is much less.
Sure.
And 20 million people live in Tokyo alone, or in Greater Tokyo, I should say.
Wow.
Tokyo itself is 11 million, I think.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of people there, and especially if you go to the bigger districts like Shinjuku and Shibuya, those places, it's always crowded. It doesn't matter what time of day you go there, except like 3 a.m. or something.
Mm.
But it's always crowded. There's always people going from A to B.
Okay.
The Shinjuku station, the train station there, is a ridiculously large station to begin with. It's also the busiest station in the world in terms of number of passengers per day.
Hmm.
3 million people go through that station every day.
Amazing.
And that's ridiculous. Yeah. It's almost impossible to imagine just how big that number is.
It is. I can't fathom it. And so there's people that will push you into the train to make sure it leaves on time?
That's true. They will just try to get you in there.
So what's your typical day like? I mean, as a PhD student, you're not taking a lot of classes, are you? You're basically working on your thesis.
Yeah, I'm basically working on my research most of the time. So, usually, I don't get up very early. I'm not really a morning person.
Okay.
In that respect, differs a little bit depending on how much work I have to do. Then I will get up, I will just, you know, eat breakfast and check Channel 9.
Right on.
Do the normal morning stuff, take a shower,
that
kind of thing. Then I will usually go to the lab.
Okay.
Which is about 40 minutes travel from where I live.
Mm.
First have to go to the station, take a train for 15 minutes, and then walk to the lab.
Okay.
Because I don't drive in Tokyo. I do have a driver's license, but I don't drive.
I can understand.
Yeah. It's parking, especially in Tokyo, is ridiculous.
Okay.
And the streets are all really narrow. It's not a really nice place to drive. And with the public transportation system that's that efficient, there's not really any reason to.
Absolutely.
So I get to the lab, and then essentially I will work usually until 6 or 7. Then I will get something to eat.
Yeah.
depending on how much work I have to do and whether or not I feel like it, I will go back to the lab and work some more.
Wow.
Or I'll go back home and sometimes work from home.
Okay.
The work I do, a lot of it, so I can just do from home anyway, because it doesn't really matter where I am.
Excellent.
Because I can just remote into all the clusters I use.
Mm-hmm.
PuTTY is one of my most used tools. It's a SSH client for Windows.
Nice.
I use that a lot.
So let me ask you, I mean, you're as a PhD student, I mean, are you not teaching any classes?
No, that's not a requirement in Japanese universities. I know that it usually is here that you have to at least TA some classes, but not in Japan. Fortunately, because it would probably be in Japanese.
How is your Japanese? You learning?
It's reasonable. I'm not really actively taking any classes right now because I don't really have the time.
Mm-hmm.
I used to take classes when I arrived, and before I arrived, I actually did some Japanese at Leiden University as well.
Okay.
My Japanese is reasonable. I can get by, and I can have normal conversations a little bit, but my vocabulary tends to run out at some points. Which, but it's decent enough. I can survive.
So now, you know, let's talk a little bit about Channel 9.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you've been on Channel 9 for, what, three years or so? 4 years?
Yeah.
3 years. And very active in the forums, giving us advice, you know, actually in some sense giving us code. So thank you for the code highlighting.
Yep.
Stuff that you gave Duncan and team.
You could do a little bit better job with processing white space in the code blocks, though.
Understood. So about that, that's kind of really what I want to get right to right now, is I want your, you know, give me your sense of what do we need to do on Channel 9? What do you like about it? What would you like to see? What is it that keeps you coming back? And what would make you spend more time there? Like what do we need? What are we missing, if we are? And just basically a brain dump of what you think we need to do on Channel 9.
Well, for me, I mostly visit the forums. I do like the videos a lot, and I try to watch them when I have time. But they tend to be a bit on the long side usually.
Uh-huh.
So
sure.
It's really a time investment because I do want to pay attention when I watch a video.
Uh-huh.
I'm not really one of those people who can put it on in the background and then do something else.
Sure.
So, I'm not really up on the most recent videos at the moment.
Fair enough.
I try to catch up on stuff I find interesting, but I am very selective about what videos I do and do not watch.
Okay.
Most of the time I spend on Channel 9 is really on the forums part. Yeah, what we need there, well, what I've been saying since the beginning, is moderators in multiple time zones.
Yes.
Because you see sometimes this whole sea of spam appearing, mm-hmm. and then there's nobody online who can actually do anything about it.
Are you a moderator?
I'm not.
You're not? Well, we'll have to change that. All right, continue.
okay. Yeah. Marcus Spam works reasonably well. I'm not entirely sure if it's currently automatic or if it just sends a message or something to someone.
Well, the way it works now is the way it's implemented, what it used to be, I don't even know if it's there anymore, but when it was there, basically what I would do is I'd go to an RSS feed. So every time you hit report something as spam, it updates an RSS feed that I'm watching.
And then
go to it and then delete it. Now we have Duncan added some code that's incredibly useful. So when I go to a lot of my stuff gets spammed all the time. So I just go to my profile when I'm logged in. I get to see all my videos, and it shows basically the latest one that's been updated. I can tell immediately which ones are being spammed. Typically, they're the older ones. They start bubbling up to the top. So what I can do now is go to that person's profile, delete all their posts from their profile, and permanently ban them. And so, as you've noticed, we're starting to really a little bit catch up to the spam as far as
it's been getting better.
Blast it away. But no, you're right. We need a Marcus spam that actually works, or we need more moderators in multiple time zones.
Yeah, because I think the automated approach is what we had before, is that it would automatically hide a post if enough people marked it as spam.
Uh-huh.
That was too easily abused.
Yes.
Because I do think that, as annoying as some of the people on Channel 9 may be, like Corona Coder or something.
Sure.
and we don't always agree with them, and some of them may be downright trolls or something, but it's not spam, and you should still allow that kind of thing as long as they don't plaster the forum with hundreds of posts.
Agreed.
So, and if you have an automatic mark of spam feature, people will start to use it to get rid of those posts as well,
mm-hmm.
which we saw happening last time that was implemented before V4.
Okay.
So I really think that manual moderation is the only real solution, and for that you just need more moderators to keep it sort of manageable.
Agreed, and I think it's a great idea. We need to have them, as you've been saying, located geographically such that 24-hour.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. We will do that. I mean, we've already... I'm surprised we didn't make you the moderator. We're going to have to fix that. I mean, so, essentially, the problem that I've had in the past... remember, when we started Channel 9, I mean, the team was sort of rebellious, and Len was kind of like the socialist, you know, we were a very liberal team. We were like, no, man, anybody can talk. That's why Beer 28, I didn't ban him for like 2 years, maybe longer, 3 years, because we liked people who don't always have the same opinion. I mean, in fact, we celebrated that for a while until it started getting disrespectful. And so the problem that I've had personally with making one niner more important than another niner, I mean, we had conversations early on in the team around, you know, special niners because they post a lot. And my attitude was always like, ah, that's bullshit, man, because there's lots of niners who never post on Channel 9. Yet, by traffic, we know that they're there. So, but in your case, I think we may need to start modifying the notion of, if you want to be a moderator on Channel 9, we could ask you. And the people that we'd ask would be, A, the people that are always on the forums, and B, the people who, you know, have created useful posts. So I'm not going to ask Corona Coder to be, sorry, if you're Beer 28 or whatever your name is, Corona, not going to happen, my man. But keep speaking your mind. That's okay. But you, I can think of other people as well. And because you're in Japan...
like Andy or something, he would also be an excellent candidate.
Okay,
ABC.
Cool. And where is he? He's in
know.
England.
I'm not sure. I'm
perfect.
Not sure.
So we'd have England, so we'd have the UK, sort of, you know, Northern Europe, or Central, wherever it is in Europe. I guess it's sort of Northern-y. And then Japan, and South America, and North America is easy, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, South America is mainly in the same time zones as North America, so that's not really...
It's a little off, depending upon where you are in North America. So if you go from Seattle to Rio, there's a fair amount of difference. But you're right, it's not radical.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you have people in America and you have people in Europe, then you have already enough overlap to catch that, I think.
Cool. So America, Europe, Japan.
Yeah.
All right, Niners, we got to figure this out. And a moderator will be able to... We need to talk about that as a team and a community. What is a moderator able to do? I don't want a moderator to be an admin like me, right? Because I can go and delete everything. We don't really want that power.
Yeah.
So perfect, man. What else? So the videos are too long.
Yeah, I'm not saying they're too
that's
long. Especially the Going Deep series. They need to be long.
Yeah, they do.
They need to have a lot of detail. But
it's a time commitment.
It's, yeah.
Well, here's what I'd recommend you that you know, we one of the things, since we offer so many formats, is during your commute, which isn't that long. I mean, if you could get these onto your mobile device, it'd be a good way to like stand and like listen.
Yeah.
To something.
I usually read during my commute.
Fair enough.
So
fair enough.
It's my reading time.
So what else?
What else? Well, availability and reliability is still sometimes a problem.
We're working on
you probably
that.
Know that.
Amen.
It's especially... it might not be so bad from here, but from Japan, where the delays are a bit longer,
mm-hmm.
you sometimes get, with the Ajax stuff, you just get stuck with the rotating symbol, and then it stays there like that for 2 minutes.
Exactly.
So that can be very annoying.
Mm-hmm. There is something to be said for the kind of sequential experience, right? And on the one hand, the power of asynchronous kind of computation in the case of a website is, yes, it's cool that my UI is still responsive. But in some sense, even with AJAX, you don't necessarily know the status of the computation that's happening somewhere else.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you can have the little wheel going or whatever, but I think we could be better about, in general, across the industry, of making it, you know, at least have some better user experience for asynchronous computation on a web page. And not just AJAX everywhere because it's cool.
Yeah. You have no idea whether or not the site has actually responded and you're just downloading stuff, or whether you're still waiting for the server to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, or if you're still actually sending your data or whatever.
Yeah.
So that can be very annoying.
Totally. So you're into airplanes, man. I see on your Facebook and comments on Channel 9, and are you going to be a pilot?
No, I'm not going to be a pilot.
No.
For one thing, I got into it a little bit too late.
Okay.
Basically, I haven't really gotten into the whole aviation thing until about 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
So by that time, I was already well on my way getting my master's, so didn't really want to switch.
Sure.
Also, I think being a pilot is a day-to-day job. Might not be all that interesting, because as they say, it's hours of boredom and minutes of terror.
Okay.
Especially if you're on commercial jet lines, it's most of the time you're just staring at what the autopilot is doing.
Fair enough.
Yeah, there are people who love doing that, but I need to work with my mind, and I think that being a pilot as a job,
sure,
would be too boring.
But you could get your pilot license, and once you create your company and make, you know, $1 billion, you just go fly jets around. It's fun.
Yeah, well, I do intend at some point to get a private pilot license.
Yes.
Problem with that right now is money. Especially because I'm in Japan. Japan is the most expensive country in the world to fly in. Yeah, it costs, to get a private pilot license in the U.S. will cost you maybe $8,000.
Okay.
To get one in Japan, you have to think like $30,000.
Wow.
So it's way, way more expensive.
Understood.
They also don't really like general aviation that much. Mm. There is not that much general aviation in Japan.
Okay.
And if you look for flight schools, they're almost always commercial flight schools. There's very few actual private schools that just teach for hobbyists, basically. There's some ultralight stuff, but that's all very far away.
Absolutely.
And still very expensive.
Cool. So what's next on your list while you're here in Seattle?
What's next? That's a good question.
Have you visited a bunch of these buildings? Have you met some people? Is Christian taking you around to meet people?
Not yet. Christian is very busy at the moment with his own work, which he can't talk about.
Understood. Yes.
So I don't know exactly what it is. I know he works in SQL Azure, but and what he's doing, I have no idea.
Sure.
But he has a lot of meetings.
I'm sure. Well, he's a PM, so that stands for Professional Meeting Goer. Just kidding.
Yeah. Almost seems like it.
Very cool. Well, maybe we'll take a tour around campus.
Yeah, I do hope I'll get the chance to meet some more people here.
Of course.
Of course, I've been to Mount Rainier, but there's some other stuff around in the area, like Olympia National Park, which I also want to visit.
Good. The Olympic National Park.
Olympic, yeah.
Yeah, that's a beautiful place. And you're getting an outrageous weather, so.
Yeah, I've been very, very lucky with the weather.
Very cool. Well, hey, man, thank you for coming and spending some time talking about yourself.
Thank you for having me. I hope this was not too boring for
not at all. People are watching this. People. It's always good to know what Niners are, who they are, what they're thinking, and what they're doing. Right? It's good to turn the camera around, not just always focus on.
I think that's something also I suggested a long time ago. Actually, that you interview some Niners via Skype or something. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, the problem is that I just don't think the technology is up to snuff, man. And I think the experience when you're as a watcher of an interview done over a webcam, it's not as nice as like what we're looking at right now. And so, if we could figure out, perhaps I think Niners coming to PDC, this is actually be a great year to do that. Because we'll have a big presence down there with Channel 9.
But if you do that, then you don't really get the international crowd so much, because BDC is hard to get to for people who are in Europe. Or
we get a fair number. Yeah. You'd be surprised. A lot of the we get a lot of Germans. We get a lot of Japanese. I mean, but you're right.
Yeah, but I mean, from the Niners in specific, people who are on the forums.
Got it.
Not everybody is working as a professional developer for a company who spends money on sending people to BDC.
This is true. This is absolutely true. We'll, you know, the other thing we could always do is have Niners interview Niners, give them a way to publish a Channel 9, right? That's something that we've wanted to do for a while. It's just hard to figure out what the formula is.
Didn't Min at some point
make a video? Min did a really cool one, man.
Clip.
He did.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Min's a creative guy. He's a smart ass as well, which is good. I like smart asses. It's good to have.
Yeah.
Right on, man. Well, keep it up, man.
Okay,
thank you.
For
being a great Niner. We really appreciate it. And you're going to get a bunch more Nine Guys to take back with you.
Okay, great. I'll spread them all around Japan.
Spread them all around Japan. Take care.